Little Ozzy led Black Sabbath for a purpose, though. On Coast to Coast AM, as we're talking about Strange Stars, a book that I think does the first, like, this is such an overused expression, I hate to use it, but I'm going to anyway. The first real deep dive into this nexus of science fiction writing, Hugo Award-winning novels, stories, films, and how they impacted greatly popular music. And then in return, how popular music and these stories also got right in the middle of the actual science that wasn't fiction at all that was happening. And so we'll talk more about that coming up, particularly about that song, which I've apparently been misreading all of these years. All the years I've been listening to that song, I've been getting it wrong. We'll tell you more about, and maybe you too, but we'll do it in just a second with the author Jason Heller. Hey, been keeping an eye on Hawaii. Prayers and, you know, all to them. Looking for updates, haven't had one, still getting pounded with rain. They're in the danger zone. When you wake up in the morning, find out what happened with Hawaii overnight. It's a scary time. And apparently with all of the rain, they could be getting as many as 40 inches of rain on these islands. And I was just there. I've never had a bad time in Hawaii. Hawaii's great. I know George spends a lot of time there. I was just there with my wife on Kauai, which makes me worried about the chickens. The wild feral chickens of Kauai, which, I mean, they're all over the island, everywhere you go. That and feral pigs and wild dogs. So, I mean, there's a lot of wildlife out there and, you know, a lot of flooding, and hoping for the best and be ready, because we may all have to do a little contribution here or there coming up in the weeks ahead to get them back on their feet through the Red Cross. Don't ever forget Puerto Rico, too. But we'll get back to this science fiction that were in songs, or songs that were actual little science fiction narratives you may never have realized, coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. In for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett. Strange Stars, Jason Heller. So, you know, I know it's a minor mention in the overall, you know, mindscape of the book, but that I think that part about Black Sabbath being based on a science fiction work, that kind of surprised me. I thought it was, I always, for some reason, just because I had the comic book at the time, I always thought it was some riff he was doing on the Marvel character Iron Man, not something else.
Yeah, there were, it's funny because, you know, Black Sabbath gets so much credit for, all rightly so, for the way they pioneered heavy metal music, and they also pioneered heavy metal music using science fiction, which bands, some of the, you know, heavy metal bands of the 70s that really set the tone for everything that came after, bands like the Scorpions and Judas Priest, they all had science fiction songs as well, and Sabbath kind of got that whole genre started along those lines.
Yeah, not to mention Spinal Tap. But tell the story of, like, so what's the real story? What's the song about Iron Man?
Oh, yeah. So Iron Man is basically, you know, Ozzy Osbourne at the time, and it's sometimes hard to, in retrospect, for people to remember that these are Vietnam-era songs that that Black Sabbath were singing on their first few albums, and many of them are anti-war songs, and it's basically a science fiction narrative about a warmongering construct, a giant robot, basically, that is out waging war and then has, you know, a realization about what it's doing. And it's really interesting to see, as the 60s were turning into the 70s, how a lot of the artists that were making protest songs started to use science fiction as a way to tell a different kind of protest song, instead of just nailing it right on the nose, that right here we could actually take a lot of the situations that were existing at the time and put them in a narrative or wrap them in a science fiction allegory. Paul Kantner of Jefferson Airplane was another person who did that a lot. And his 1970 solo album, Blows Against the Empire, which is a science fiction concept album, is very much a continuation of the radical politics that he injected into Jefferson Airplane's music, but he paired it with his love for science fiction and wrote an entire story and a song cycle about how politics would play out if people were leaving Earth to escape all the social and political ills that were going on at the time. So in a lot of ways, the science fiction bent that a lot of artists had going into the 70s was an outgrowth of what had been going on in the 60s, and artists were just looking for new ways to express some of these ideas.
So it kind of closed the loop, because as a kid, Paul Kantner of Jefferson Airplane had been reading Hugo award-winning science fiction books, then becomes a recording artist, has hits with Jefferson Airplane, then puts out a solo album, which in return gets nominated for a Hugo Award. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, it is. It was the first album up for a very long time, until very recently, that was nominated for a Hugo Award, for science fiction's highest honor. And that is something that I wish I could see more of, and maybe here things will start to change a bit. You never know, but you know, science fiction is something that obviously is viewed to be the province of literature, the province of cinema, TV, and that's all understandable, but there are so many artists out there, obviously since back in the late 60s on, who have been using music as a way to express their idea of science fiction, their own science fiction stories, worlds, sagas that take place over multiple albums in some cases.
Right.
And they're never really recognized for it. And that's one thing that I really wanted to do with Strange Stars, was point out that some of these people have not gotten the recognition that maybe they're due.
All right. And I'm going to push you on a point on that in a moment, because I as a reader of the book, I underlined a lot, dog-eared a lot of pages. I was intrigued by things, and I had to go back and listen to them because it had been a while since I had. Before I do, though, I want to make a point that it's a very interesting explanation, and you are pulling on threads that people, you know, haven't thought a lot about for a long time. Maybe never, like myself, really sat down and wondered about the lyrics of Iron Man. So that was a kind of an oh wow moment, and there's a lot of them. But I also think this is a point worth making, that I think when you say science fiction is the place of literature and I think there's a time when we get into the Frank Herberts, right, and Dune, and we get into the Heinleins and Philip K. Dick and all of these other people who really elevate science fiction. But, and this, you know, a good example of this would be Jimi Hendrix, is that really this wasn't the province of English class. This was the province of AV club. This was the province of math geeks. This wasn't right. I mean, they weren't like, we don't associate science fiction with the cool kids who are, you know, putting down hot licks on a guitar. We associate science fiction with the nerdy guys with the, you know, army issue glasses with the Band-Aid in the middle. That's kind of how we think about that, I think. I mean, generally in pop culture, fair or not. And that's what's so interesting about your book, is you make this connection. And Jimi Hendrix is what I'm going to ask you about here, who was a major science fiction fan and like one of the coolest guitarists that ever lived.
He was. And what's interesting is, if you scratch the surface of Jimi Hendrix, of course, one of the coolest human beings to ever walk the face of the earth, I don't think anyone can really deny that, you did have a geek. He was a shy, introverted, bookish guy. And there actually is that dichotomy you see with, obviously not all rock stars, but a lot of them, where they can go out and perform on stage, but actually in real life, they can be kind of geeky. Paul Kantner was like that, for sure. Obviously,
David Crosby.
David Crosby, you know, there's a lot of, it's never as cut and dried as someone's either an extroverted rock star or an introverted nerdy guy. And that was what was really another point that I really tried to make in the book, was not just tell these kind of bigger stories about the, you know, the sweeping movements that were being made in music and culture and civilization, but the personal stories about a lot of these artists, whether it's Neil Peart, the drummer and lyricist of Rush, or whether it's George Clinton from Parliament, you know, and then, of course, David Bowie, Hendrix, all these other people that we've talked about. What were their stories? What was it that drew them? Sometimes it was an interest in UFOs more than science fiction. Sometimes it was an interest in technology in the real world, or the whole idea of futurism as much as it was science fiction. But all this was a big kind of seething stew of ideas and themes and images and also emotions, fears and hopes that so many of these artists sculpted into some of this really amazing music from the 70s.
But another way I think that science fiction novels impacted popular songwriting, which in turn impacted science fact and actual scientific exploration, is right along those lines. Because I think, and I've known a lot of scientists over the years, and I've known one or two of the, you know, those people who are really interested in, like, you know, aeronautics and travel in space and everything, they were validated by the fact that those books had become the themes from songs I hadn't even picked up on. But they felt like that was, it was like, oh, I, you know, here's Crosby, Stills, and Nash singing a song about wooden ships, which is actually a song about spaceships, and it's a little science fiction record in and of itself. And I think people who otherwise would not have been recognized for their brilliance or for their ability to understand space travel and all these other things, which had become topic A everywhere, they felt validated. They were encouraged by the fact that this had become mainstream everywhere they went. It allowed them to get cool by extension.
Oh, I think so for sure. Definitely. And the way all these things are interconnected and these kind of various seemingly unconnected spheres, you know, that was another thing I really wanted to point out. And the more I researched the book, the more I found these amazing connections. One of my favorite anecdotes in the book is the time in 1975 when Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, who at that point is a little bit in between fortunes, you know, he had failed to revive Star Trek. He had brought it back as an animated series that had just been canceled and didn't really do that particularly well. And he was still trying to get Star Trek greenlit as a motion picture and was still a couple years away from doing that. And he gets summoned by Paul McCartney to come to a Wings concert. And as it turns out, Paul McCartney is a huge Gene Roddenberry fan. He basically comes up to Gene Roddenberry backstage after the Wings concert and treats Gene Roddenberry like he's the rock star. Right. And Paul McCartney is fawning over him and basically tells him, I want to do a Wings concept album that is Battle of the Bands in Outer Space, kind of like maybe Band on the Run in Outer Space.
Right.
And he wants to hire Gene Roddenberry to write it for him. And Gene Roddenberry is just completely taken aback by this and winds up doing it. And, of course, that's a project that never got produced. And apparently there's some of the treatments and concept ideas sitting in a file folder somewhere that in Gene Roddenberry's many archives that are left after his death. But the point that amazed me about that entire anecdote when I stumbled across it was the fact that there were people who were at the pinnacle of coolness and rock stardom who were still just total fanboys for people like Gene Roddenberry. And even Gene Roddenberry couldn't believe it. And I think that really speaks to the influence that science fiction was really having on people during that decade, particularly other creative types.
Yep, I think that's it. And let's close the loop on the Jimi Hendrix thing, because the song Purple Haze came from an expression from a book he was reading that described a purplish haze. So just mention that quickly, and then we'll start looking ahead a little bit, because I want people to be able to join in this conversation, and I know the phones will go crazy for you. So
absolutely, yeah.
Tell that story.
Yeah, Jimi Hendrix, again, a lifelong science fiction fan, had been reading the science fiction author Philip Jose Farmer, and there was a phrase that leapt out at him from the pages about a planet that had, quote-unquote, a purplish haze. And that phrase just always stuck in Hendrix's mind. When he sat down and wrote Purple Haze, the lyrics were originally pages and pages long, and they had all this detail and all these storylines about intergalactic wars and the moons of Jupiter and all this. And he used the phrase purple haze for the title of the song. But what wound up happening was, when he chopped all those pages of lyrics down to a short song that could actually get played on the radio, none of those science fiction lyrics made the cut. But Purple Haze, Jimi Hendrix's breakthrough hit and probably still his most famous song, was actually began life as a science fiction song, and that was the spark of inspiration. And of course, Hendrix went on to write other more explicitly science fiction songs. But Purple Haze, that's where it began life, and the phrase itself, the title, that very famous title, is from Philip Jose Farmer, just paraphrased very slightly.
You know, it makes me wonder, in a way, why people like Jimi Hendrix, who spoke openly about his interest, you know, he wasn't shy about that. But in a way, I think people just are so inclined to think that anything that he thought of that was out of this world or dreamy, or that all had to come from the drugs. And it wasn't. It was just from his imagination and, as you say, his homage to his favorite books as a kid. And I think that's very cool. That's much different than I would have. It changed my perspective on several of those songs. So I'm going to play Wooden Ships coming up here after the break. But that's another one that, as I mentioned earlier, this one ties together David Crosby and Paul Kantner, right? They were both science fiction geeks.
Yep, and obviously both friends, you know, both being, you know, prominent California rock bands at the time. And, yeah, the song is, you know, I think people have been hearing that song for decades and decades without realizing that it's a science fiction song, but they would, when they would play the song live in the late 60s, early 70s, they would sometimes introduce it as, hey, this is a science fiction song. That's exactly what Crosby would say from the stage. He wanted it to be known that, hey, of course, Crosby being another one of these people from that generation who grew up reading science fiction and has always championed it in one way or another. You know, a lot of things were done symbolically or metaphorically, but when you scratch the surface of it, yeah, that's it. There's science fiction at the heart of it.
You know, and just to, again, just to circle back to Paul McCartney and his love of science fiction, remember, it's McCartney who performs live via a live show he was performing in California to the space station, to the people who were there at the space station, and he talked to them while they were up there, the international crew at the space station. And that's just, I mean, this is this kind of connection where, again, goes science, science fiction, science fact, and some of the biggest, most popular songs of all time. Well, there's more to get to. But here's what I am going to do. I'm going to open up the phones here and try and get at least a few calls for Jason Heller before the top of the hour, and then we'll do open lines for the rest of the show. So your question about a song or an artist or about a science fiction work and where it had its biggest impact, we'll get to all that coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Jason Heller takes your calls, Strange Stars, coming up. You can link up to that by going to coasttocoastam.com. I'm going to call an audible here real quick, though, because I see on the first-time caller line that Josh is in Hawaii. Nathan, can you bring up Josh for us real quick, since it's all we're thinking about are the people in Hawaii tonight. Josh, get that radio down in the background if you can. Just tell me, where are you in the chain?
Yeah, we're out here in Maui, Hawaii.
Okay, and how is the storm going for you so far?
So far, the rain just started. It's been off and on. We've seen a lot of disasters all throughout the whole Hawaiian Islands. It's been off and on where I'm at in Maui, and I'm located up in Kula, and it's been pretty much off and on, just rain, not so much wind, but all in all, the rest of the Hawaiian Islands has been a disaster.
All right. Well, I just wanted to check you're okay long enough to hang on hold then for a minute, and you'll be the first one up when we bring in callers for Jason Heller coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Jason Heller is the author of Strange Stars, a Hugo Award-winning author, but we're talking about that period of time with the golden age of science fiction novelists, some of the most famous of all time, and then the growth of the appreciation of mainstream sci-fi through popular music and its impact on science and NASA and culture as we have it today. And then we'll do open lines coming up at the top of the hour. So, Jason, I'm going to grab Josh just because it's raining hard in Hawaii and I want him to keep his head on a swivel. But he's the first one with a question for you on Coast to Coast AM. Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about Gene Roddenberry and how all his inventions did come about. Yeah. Futuristic, whatchamacallit?
But things like the tricorder and the, yeah, all of his little gadgets on the show that eventually ended up being used, or at least versions of that are used in real life. Excellent point. Stay in the high ground, Josh, and let me get Jason Heller's response to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one thing that wound up being the kind of the most concrete expression of that was when the prototype for the space shuttle was rolled out in 1976. And, of course, there'd been a big letter-writing campaign to have it named the Enterprise. And it worked.
Yeah.
And not only was that first shuttle named the Enterprise, when it was unveiled out on the tarmac by personal invitation by NASA, was the actual cast of Star Trek. Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner and the whole crew there for it, which kind of brought things, you know, full circle. You know, it had been a decade since Star Trek, and it had entered popular consciousness through reruns and syndication to the point where people actually wanted a real spaceship, not just any spaceship, but the next spacecraft in the whole new phase of NASA space exploration, the spacecraft of the future, as it was, you know, kind of build at the time. They wanted it to be named the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, one of those kind of really beautiful moments, I think, and where there's this exchange between pop culture and real life science and technology and exploration.
Not to mention the fact that then two of those attendees, Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner, were also recording artists. Sort of.
Yes. And actually, Nichelle Nichols as well, yeah. Lesser known, in the 70s, of course, who played Uhura on the show, also released some music, which is pretty captivating and interesting. And I actually do talk about that in the book as well.
I came across this little factoid I thought was interesting. Was that Julie London, torch singer from the 50s and early 60s, who later goes on to have probably her best known role in the TV show Emergency. I think her character's name was Dixie or something. But anyway, she is the artist, as a recording artist. Julie London was the woman who was played most to the astronauts during the space program as part of the wake-up calls.
That's so interesting. It's, you know, and I believe you've written about this, haven't you, about the whole history of what actually the musical relationship is between popular music and...
And Capcom in particular, and the capsule, and how they used to wake up, the tunes they used to play, some of them dreadful, that they would play to wake up the astronauts in the morning. Like all of that Herb Alpert, which is okay a little bit, but I don't think that's the first song I want to hear when I'm in space. It's Sitting Bull.
It's jarring, right? The juxtaposition of being in outer space and hearing something like, you know, hearing Spanish Flea by Herb Alpert. Like, what the hell?
And that honk honk thing. Or let's get to Dobley, who's in Ohio, east of the Rockies, for Jason Heller. Go ahead. Am I pronouncing that right? Dobley or Dobley?
Oh, Dobler.
Oh, thank you. Go ahead.
Hey, first and foremost, Ian, it's a pleasure to be on with you. I always enjoy whenever you host the show. Now, I've been hearing you speak of a lot of older musicians. So I want to touch on four newer musicians. Well, the first one, actually, you've been speaking of, David Bowie. Just a quick anecdote there. I thought that the song Black Star was a very appropriate swan song for David Bowie. I mean, he must have known that he was on his way out.
Sure.
But then a huge inspiration for Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails was David Bowie. And he went on to release an album by the title of Year Zero, which is set in a not so far off dystopian future where everything is being monitored and tracked, and there's a resistance against that. And then another artist is 30 Seconds to Mars. Especially their first album that came out, self-titled. It's another full-on concept album set, I believe, probably a little bit further in the future. And then the final would be Our Lady Peace, Spiritual Machines, which is an entire concept album about machines becoming sentient. And then one last thing is the Nine Inch Nails Year Zero was actually slated to be a TV show, but that never panned out, which is sad. I would have loved to have watched that, but I was just curious if either of you were familiar with either of those three artists or albums.
Sure, but just also you should know then that the period that he focuses on here is up to about 1980, so that's why we haven't talked about any of the other artists, because there's a ton of them, and you're right about those. But we have a bunch of people hanging on for you, Jason. Did you want to comment on one of those?
Yeah, I would love to. Absolutely, real quickly. I'm also a music critic for Pitchfork and The Atlantic and NPR, and I absolutely love so many of the current science fiction influenced artists, some of whom you just mentioned, great ones. And, you know, there's all kinds of artists and groups carrying on that tradition now. As Ian mentioned, my book focuses on the 70s and kind of this heyday of science fiction-influenced music. But, you know, today we have R&B artists like Janelle Monáe. We have rock groups like Coheed and Cambria. There's all kinds of people out there still continuing these traditions and the ones you mentioned as well. And it's amazing to me to see how that echoes, how it continues, and there's this tradition of science fiction music. Now that we're actually in the future that a lot of these bands from the 70s were singing about 40 years ago.
Not to mention that Janelle is featured as an actress in the movie, the Figures movie. What was the
Hidden Figures? Yep.
Hidden Figures about the space program. So again, closing that loop. All right, let's get to James is in Philly on a wild card line on Coast to Coast AM for Jason Heller. James?
Yes. Hey, good morning, guys. This is a great subject. Jason, you focus on the 70s. I want to bring up a group that I became interested in when they first came. They came in the tail end of the 70s, Yellow Magic Orchestra. Do you talk about them in your book? Are you familiar with them?
I do, absolutely. I have Yellow Magic Orchestra and Ryuichi Sakamoto in there at the very tail end of the book, absolutely. You know, as a band that was, you know, bringing this new form, one of the bands at the time bringing in, you know, new forms of electronic music, and not just the way that they composed and created music, which in itself was futuristic, but the way, you know, their music really kind of reflected this new perception, this new kind of urban reality that was coming into being as technology was accelerating around everywhere, and the disparity between accelerating technology and economic depression in a lot of major metropolitan areas. And Yellow Magic Orchestra were able to kind of sum all that up in a way that was really kind of upbeat in a lot of ways, and they influenced so many artists, of course, beyond that. You know, they were a hugely influential band that doesn't get mentioned as much, which is, of course, a little bit of a crime, really, because they absolutely were so ahead of the curve on what they were doing.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Joe is in Santa Cruz for Jason Heller, author of Strange Stars.
Guys, what a great show, man. Anyway, I just want to say my favorite sci-fi song is Red Barchetta by Rush, and I think that song exemplifies sci-fi. And I think Rush is just one of the greatest bands, like 2112, and even they gave a shout-out to them in Ready Player One, too. And I just want to say, awesome show, guys. You guys rule. Oh, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
I appreciate that. I haven't even thought about Red Barchetta in years. But, yes, I know just what he's talking about. Let me go to Josette. She's in Vancouver, B.C., on Coast to Coast AM for Jason Heller. Josette?
Yes, hi, Ian. It's wonderful to have you back on again. Just very briefly, you mentioned my name on the air in 2008 when I went to the Dark Shadows convention.
Ah, fun.
Yeah.
Are you still into it?
And I've enjoyed everything you've done, science fiction related, and I hope you have Dean Koontz on again sometime
too. Yeah.
Now, back to this subject. These are a couple of things that were not touched upon yet, and maybe you've mentioned them in your book, but I'm a huge record collector myself, and I have about 40,000 45s, and I have what are called break-in records. They are the ones that Dickie Goodman and all those people did.
Oh, yeah.
And there's well over 500 break-in records.
Yeah, like the Jaws record, and then there's one about them, yeah.
Were science fiction related, and of course UFO related, and of course they did some political stuff too. Dickie Goodman did, but he did stuff through into the 70s. And the other thing I wanted to mention is I don't get to as many science fiction cons as I used to go to, but back in the late 70s I attended some of them in the Bay Area, and that's how I became acquainted with science fiction folk music, which is music that various fans wrote and sang at conventions, and there's so much good stuff out there. I believe there's a website called filk.com or something. If you go onto that, you could get acquainted with a lot of it, and I was wondering if he touched upon any of these things, the break-ins and the...
Okay. Jason, what about...
The great points to bring up. And, I go to science fiction conventions as well. I was just at Worldcon in San Jose last week. And I do talk about Filk in the book. And actually, you know, one thread of the many that I try to weave through the book is the rise and kind of the solidification of science fiction fandom in the 70s, mostly through conventions. And I do talk about Filk and the way that it kind of grew as, you know, this collective and live shared, you know, musical phenomenon, ritual, really, that began happening at conventions, and the importance that it played, apart from the popular musicians, you know, making records and releasing them. This was, you know, much more obviously in the folk tradition, where you played it together with the people in your community, in this case, the science fiction community. Great point. And now, of course, many folk artists do record and have music out on CDs and stuff like that, you know, with science fiction and fantasy themes that, you know, you can go online and find a whole world of this music out there that you'll usually never hear on the radio or outside the science fiction community. So there's some great stuff there to track down.
Well, they may be hearing about it maybe for the first time tonight, which is great. And they can find out more about your book by linking up to us at the website, coasttocoastam.com. We have time probably for one, maybe two, if we keep it short. Brian is in Wheaton, Illinois, on a wild card line for Jason Heller. Brian?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, guys. My question is this. There's an artist from the early 80s. His name was Peter Schilling, and he wrote a tribute song called Major Tom, I'm Coming Home, for Bowie, and well, in relation to Bowie. I'm just kind of wondering, how was that received by Bowie, if he ever actually commented on that, and if you know anything about that.
Yeah, we know the song. It was a huge hit.
I was about 11 years old when that song came out, and I was infatuated with Peter Schilling's song Major Tom because it's sort of a prequel to David Bowie's Space Oddity. And I of course at 11 was already aware of Space Oddity, and I at that young age I couldn't comprehend how one person could use another person's character from a song me being pretty naive back then, being just a little kid in the 80s. But when I went to write Strange Stars, I really did want to try to find some kind of background on that, but I couldn't find any mention of Bowie actually for the record having any kind of reaction to that song, to Peter Schilling's kind of fan fiction in song form is how I always sort of think about it. You know, fan fiction is, of course, where someone will take, Tolkien and write, you know, their own story using the Lord of the Rings characters. And that's kind of what Peter Schilling did. He just, you know, this German pop star who loved David Bowie and loved Space Oddity and said, I want to write a song using this character. But it's a beautiful song, great song, one of the great one-hit wonders of the 80s for sure.
But remember, you know, as you point out, that's exactly what David Bowie did. I mean, Starman Jones, and then he writes his own song Starman, and his last name is Jones. I mean, there's something, if anybody can't complain about it too much about using somebody else's characters, it should be David Bowie, at least in some respects, because he borrowed even the theme from Starman Jones. And I'll play that as a bumper coming up, by the way, at after this when we go into open lines. But I will, this is cool. I mean, I was a disc jockey, actually, when that song came out in the 80s, and I played it. And I do think the only person I heard comment on it at the time was his lawyer. And they said there's nothing we can do about it. All right, well, so here's what it's going to be. Everybody who's on hold, if you want to hang on, we'll use you to start off open lines coming up. Strange Stars is the name of the book. Jason Heller, I hope you had a heller good time. Did you?
I sure did. Thank you so much, Ian. I appreciate it.
I wish we could have answered the one question I could never get an answer to, is why didn't Klaatu's calling occupants of interplanetary craft win a Hugo Award?
I know, and it should have, shouldn't it?
Yeah, if not them, at least the Carpenter's version of it should have won a Hugo Award.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Great album, great band, but both of their albums from the 70s are incredible science fiction albums.
All right, and I'm big on Alan Parsons Project, which is why I'm playing iRobot here. We look forward to hearing more about what you do in the future, and I know we'll be getting a lot of comments about this book coming up when we do Open Lines next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.